From Washington, D.C., this is America's Business with Mike Hambrick.
Brought to you in part by Toyota. Toyota, moving forward. And by Microsoft Office Visio 2007. Visualize, explore, and communicate. And by the National Association of Manufacturers. We're the millions of people who make things.
Now, from Washington, here's Mike Hambrick.
Hello and welcome to America's Business, the radio program that follows the people and the issues that matter most to manufacturing. I'm Mike Hambrick. We have what I think is a very interesting and very timely program lined up for you this week. The election, of course, has finally come to a close, and America has selected its next president, the NAM, and I would like to congratulate President-elect Barack Obama, the 44th president of the United States of America. Of course, a new president brings new change, changes our manufacturing sector will have to be ready for. We'll hear from the NAM and its members and how they're preparing to react to this change when we talk with the president of the National Association of Manufacturers, Governor John Engler. There were lots of surprising and some not-so-surprising races won on election night. Here to clear up everything for us is the NAM's political pundit, Jay Timmons. Jay is here to talk about who won and who lost on election night and what it all means. Election Day was an exciting and historic day. Record crowds made it out to the polls and cast their votes. Here this week to break down why the people voted the way they did and check their predictions are pollsters John McLaughlin and Alan Rivlin. We'll take a break from the elections to learn about a peerless manufacturer, the Peerless Chain Company. We'll learn what goes into making change from the president of Peerless Chain Company, Tom Wynn. Well, that's our lineup for this week. We hope you stay with us through the hour. Let's move on now to my first guest. Barack Obama has been elected to become the next president of the United States. A lot of people are looking at the National Association of Manufacturers to see how they react to this change in administration. We have in the studio now the president of the National Association of Manufacturers, Governor John Engler, to explain how the NAM plans on working with the Democratic administration. Governor Engler, welcome to the program. It's good to have you back with us. First of all, Governor, what is your message to President-elect Obama?
The National Association of Manufacturers has reached out to President-elect Obama and to his new administration and said, look, manufacturing is the lifeblood of this economy. We still represent $1.6 plus trillion dollars of economic impact on an annual basis. We want to work with you. We've got a lot of problems ahead as we look to the future. We're in a recession. Globally, the economies of countries all over the world are slowing down. So we need help, and we need to be thinking long-term about what's going to make a difference to allow the U.S. to remain the greatest manufacturing economy in the world.
You know, Governor, there's been a lot of discussion regarding the NAM's approach to the new administration and new members of Congress on issues important to manufacturing, that somehow the NAM has got to do this total redo and revamping of how to push the American manufacturer's agenda. Too much made of that? Is that inaccurate to think that has to be done?
It's a good question, but let's start with our process, because we actually are a member-driven organization. So we don't develop the policy based on who's in the Congress. We develop the policy and the objectives that we have for Congress based on who's in manufacturing in America and what their needs are and what's it take to compete globally. One of the things that changes all the time is how tough the competition is that's out there. People all over the world are working very, very hard to have what we have, to enjoy what we've enjoyed for so long. They don't take it for granted that it's our right to be the number one manufacturing economy, and we shouldn't either. And that includes elected officials in both parties. And I think for some time we've talked to Republicans and Democrats alike and said, look, you're being very, very risky in some of this behavior. You know, we really have got to think through what's important, and our message shouldn't change regardless of who's in Congress.
I know that you have sent, and the NAM has sent, an open letter to President-elect Obama. What is the spirit of that letter, and what is the substance of that letter?
Well, we're trying to do things differently. We would have sent a letter to Senator McCain as well. And our goal was with the president-elect, in this case, President-elect Obama, We're the Manufacturers Association. We congratulate you on winning the election on your impressive campaign. We want to work with you. Here are things that are important to us. Here's how we think they fit into the U.S. economy and the United States' role in the world economy. Here's what we think are items that need to be addressed by Congress, in some cases by administrators, departments that you will appoint the heads of. So here's how we can work together. Let's get started. And know this, we are ready to work with you. And as has been our case, we'll support the people who support us.
So the reality is, I hear you, Governor, is the issues important to manufacturing, the NAM agenda, has not changed and will not change as a result of the new political environment in Washington.
Well, that's right, in terms of what we're advocates for, because we're advocates for growing in the U.S., the presence, the footprint of manufacturing. And people say, well, wait a minute, how can that be? Isn't manufacturing pretty much finished in America? Isn't it going away? And I love to point out there's more than 13 million men and women working in American manufacturing. That U.S. manufacturing is still the largest manufacturing economy in the world. So we can be an advocate for that substantial economy. We can argue that it's very hard, in our opinion, to have national security or economic growth without a strong manufacturing base. Now, depending on who chairs what committees, which political party is in charge of either house of the Congress, or who the president is, or who the secretary of the treasury or labor departments are, you know, there may be issues that will arise that are going to be very different, issues that we don't have on our agenda, but now are forced to deal with, and we will do that. And we will anticipate those issues where we can and be engaged in the conversation. Others are big, tough, longstanding policy questions. Healthcare reform would certainly be one of those. Climate change is a more recent one, but just as tough and ugly and expensive at times to deal with. We're going to be in those debates, too. And those debates will see us working with Republicans and Democrats alike. The Democrats, because they chair the committees, because they have the presidency, are clearly going to play a more dominant role as a political party. But you'll find in the Democratic Party very, very different viewpoints among the different members. John Dingell has one viewpoint, and people like Markey or Waxman, they have a different viewpoint, you know? And so we will not always on any issue find ourselves aligned specifically with one entire party and aligned specifically against one other entire party. It just doesn't normally work that way.
Finally, Governor, you are a veteran of many political campaigns. How would you describe the Obama campaign?
I think there you just have to say simply the best. It was a terrific campaign, executed very, very astutely. I mean, to beat Senator Clinton in the primary was done at a time when she was pretty much the odds-on prohibited favorite, then to run a very strong general election campaign. In the case of Senator Obama, really the first campaign he's ever had against a serious Republican candidate. No doubt he was aided by very tough economic conditions and an unpopular incumbent Republican president, but nonetheless, the technical execution of the campaign, the way they scheduled, the way he spoke, the way they traveled, all of that couldn't have been any better, I think.
Governor John Engler, President and CEO of the National Association of Manufacturers. Governor, thanks for being with me today.
You're very welcome, Mike. Thank you.
Rene Giacchino with the American Justice Partnership here, battling for tort reform in America, as we do each and every week here on America's Business. It's kind of a scary thing. It's a holdover from Halloween in the courts, which tops our category of legally insane this week. Rene, tell us about it.
Well, it certainly does. Actually, it's two separate instances, Mike, in different courtrooms where individuals were chastised for their attire. First, there's Delbert Barnard, who's an intellectual property attorney, and he was criticized by Judge Randall Rader of the Washington, D.C. Federal Circuit for dressing for court as if he were about to play a round of tennis.
Huh.
Apparently what happened, and I'm sure this has happened to many other folks when they've traveled, but the suit that he had packed to wear to court when he took it out was not presentable. So instead, he went with a jacket, no tie, and a collared shirt that looked apparently to the judge like a polo, something he would have worn out on the tennis court. So the judge just kindly reminded him that the next time you show up in the courtroom here on the East Coast, don't look like you've come from the West Coast.
Situation,
a Kentucky woman lacked some fashion sense for the courtroom. Her name is Christy Arnold, a 28-year-old woman, and she was ordered to serve 3 days in jail after ignoring 2 warnings and a fine regarding her court attire. It appears that she showed up in court in front of Judge Janet Booth. This Kentucky woman showed up wearing hot pants.
Uh-huh.
And when the judge questioned her about her attire and said, "Don't you remember we talked about this?" her response was, "Well, I forgot."
In Pennsylvania, they're having trouble with health care. What's this about?
Well, in some ways, some are calling it a self-inflicted health care crisis, and that's because the rampant lawsuit industry and the liability insurance costs that have come to Pennsylvania have, in fact, now set up a situation where the doctors are leaving Pennsylvania. There's been an announcement recently, the closing of the Chestnut Hill Hospital maternity ward, and that's another casualty of this unreliable medical malpractice system that they have in Pennsylvania. Now, according to some of the folks there, they're saying that some of the women who are expecting may have to travel up to 1 hour in order to receive care at a maternity care unit. And it's the legal system that's forcing these hospitals to abandon certain high-risk procedures like the delivery of babies and even neurosurgery. And it's the legal system that's creating a health care shortage in Pennsylvania.
That is unfortunate because there's some very, very fine medical institutions in the state of Pennsylvania. I know a couple in Pittsburgh. Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh is a very fine institution.
Well, they're hoping that they can turn things around there because right now they claim Pennsylvania is the poster child for the plaintiff's bar vision of America. Sue the doctor, sue the hospital, and when they leave, support taxpayer-funded subsidies to hold on to the remaining cash cow is what folks are saying about Pennsylvania.
Well, let's hope that changes somehow. Goat of the Week, where does that go to this week?
The Goat of the Week award goes to the trial lawyers in Delaware. For many, many years, the trial lawyers, Delaware has sat at the top of the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform's rankings in terms of states that are a good tort environment. Well, that has certainly changed. It appears that the trial lawyers are trying to turn Delaware into a new asbestos lawsuit dumping ground.
Hmm.
It seems that all kinds of lawsuits, particularly those involving asbestos, and now it seems that it's going to follow on with pharmaceuticals and benzene lawsuits, they're being attracted to Delaware by the tort lawyers. And the companies, I guess, are being put on notice there. Be very careful in the state of Delaware. Previously very pro-business friendly, looks like it's now maybe becoming pro-tort bar friendly.
Renee Giacchino with the American Justice Partnership. Thanks, Renee. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Tom Wynn, president of the Peerless Chain Company in Winona, Minnesota. We'll find out how chains are made and how they're dealing with the current economic crisis. I'm Mike Hambrick. You're listening to America's Business, and we'll be right back.
Imagine, if you can, a company that is as devoted to the communities in which it does business as it is to the success of its own products. Imagine a company that not only consistently challenges its employees to try to do better, but challenges itself as well, again and again. This company is called Toyota, a company that has been doing business here for 50 years, one that has invested over $15 billion in the U.S. and spends $28 billion each year purchasing from local suppliers, a company that has helped create, along with its dealers and suppliers, hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs. Toyota, a company proud to do its small part to add to the landscape of America.
Welcome back to America's Business, the radio program that follows the issues that matter most to manufacturing. I'm Mike Hambrick. To learn more about the program or to listen to it online, which we invite you to do, go to americasbusiness.org.
We're going now to Winona, Minnesota, to speak with Tom Wynn, president of the Peerless Chain Company, to find out how chains are made and how their company is doing in this economic crisis. Tom, welcome to the program. First of all, Tom, tell me about Peerless Chain Company. I understand you have about 300 employees, and you're in Winona, Minnesota plant. Is that right?
Yeah, we've been here since 1917. We were founded by three Polish immigrant brothers that started the business in the back of a butcher shop, if you can imagine.
Really?
Yeah, making tire chains specifically for the Midwestern farmers and actually for the government, the Army, in World War I.
What are the primary uses of chains in such a high-tech culture that we're now in?
Well, it is a high-tech culture, and some of the chain is high-tech. I mean, we manufacture chains from everything from, tying out your dog to hanging a hammock in a swing set to tying down an F-16 on the deck of an aircraft carrier.
Wow.
And that is a high-tech chain. It's a specially designed chain called the one-way chain. It's designed to go into a ratcheting device that holds the aircraft down, and the sailor can only put the chain into the ratcheting device one way, so there's no margin for error. So that's something that, you're right, it is, our society has gotten much more high-tech over the years, but we're making high-tech chain. We also manufacture...
What is that chain made of?
Pardon me?
What is that chain made of?
It's made out of an alloy steel that's heat-treated for strength and ductility.
Wow. Must be pretty strong.
It is strong.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Your vehicle.
Right. As you look at a chain, I mean, I see heavy-duty chains. I mean, I have a farm, and we use chains a lot. It appears like each link is a complete unit in itself, yet it is linked to other links. How do you make that happen?
Well, we start with wire rod that we buy from a number of different steel mills, okay? And we buy it in a variety of sizes, and we buy it in a variety of materials, everything from a high-strength alloy chain to a low-carbon chain that's, say, a 1008 material. We then clean the material. We draw it down to a particular size. Then we run it through a machine that's called a former that forms the individual links, and it's formed in a chain. And then that goes from the former to the welder, where each link is individually welded. Then the chain is proof tested. All of the welded chain we make, if we tell you that chain has a working load limit of 10,000 pounds, we'll pull every link of that to 20,000 pounds before it leaves our factory.
Wow. So that's a pretty safe product by the time it leaves your facility.
Most of the product that we sell has what we call a 4-to-1 design factor.
Yeah. And I guess that the cost of energy is a big issue for you.
It is. We go through a lot of propane and natural gas because a lot of the chain that we make is heat treated. As I mentioned before, we heat treat it for increased strength and ductility. We have four induction heat treat towers and one belt furnace. So we go through a lot of natural gas, a lot of propane in the manufacturing process. Absolutely.
Tom Wynn, president of the Peerless Chain Company. Thank you, Tom, for being my guest this week on America's Business. Time now to take a look back at the way it was with Hank Cox. Hank?
Thanks, Mike. One of the true business geniuses who had a profound impact on consumer life was a guy you probably never heard of, Eldridge Johnson. As a lad in the 1880s, he was denied entry to college because his teachers thought he was too stupid. They told him to go learn a trade. So he learned to be a machinist and a very good one. But he didn't like working for other people for marginal wages, so he launched his own bookbinding business. As it happened, the recording industry was evolving at that time. Thomas Edison had invented a recording device years before, but he saw it as a dictaphone, not a music player. Along came Emily Berliner, who won a patent for a phonograph using a flat disc, but he needed a reliable motor to make it work. Johnson built him a powerful spring-driven motor, but it was so strong it moved the needle too fast. Johnson came up with what was basically a disc brake that slowed the motor when it tried to speed up. Johnson had built the first phonograph that would play a record all the way through with just one cranking up. He continued to make improvements. Soon he was selling one of the most complex machines ever sold for home use. Johnson was also a wizard at marketing. He came up with the famous dog listening to a phonograph, one ear cocked. The caption read, "His master's voice." I'm Hank Cox, and that's the way it was.
Thanks a lot, Hank. America's Business is about to take another break, but when we come back, we'll hear from pollsters John McLaughlin and Alan Rivlin to get their analysis on the recent presidential election. I'm Mike Hambrick, and you're listening to America's Business.
If U.S. manufacturing were a country by itself, it would be the eighth largest economy in the world. Think about that. The eighth largest.
Inside this ordinary-looking business lurks a secret weapon. Its name, Stuart.
Hi there.
His power, in a word, he does the impossible.
I think that's four words, actually.
He's ready.
Right.
Lucky for him, his business runs on the right kind of software. Microsoft software.
True. It's good stuff.
When a tough job rears its ugly head, Stuart and his software are ready.
Well, the thing about Microsoft is it's easy to use, and it works with all the other apps in our system.
Holy interoperability.
So I can get data from any of our servers. I've been able to pinpoint some efficiencies, and our operating costs are down significantly.
Spoken like a business success-seeking software-powered super-secret weapon.
Look, I really just prefer Stuart.
With the right software, all your people can be business success-seeking super-secret weapons. Find out how at Microsoft.com/people-ready. Microsoft, software for the people-ready business.
Welcome back to America's Business. I'm Mike Hambrick. I want to take a quick break from the recent political news to talk about an amendment to a law that could be a serious hassle to our manufacturers. The 2008 Farm Bill contains language that amends a law passed in 1900 called the Lacey Act. Here to explain to us what this all means and what it means to manufacturers is Doug Gowdy. Doug is Director of International Trade Policy at the NAM. First of all, Doug, if you would explain the issue with the 2008 Farm Bill and the amendment with so-called Lacey Act language in it. Give us an overview of that.
Sure. Well, the Lacey Act was actually, it's a 100 years old piece of legislation that was originally passed to prevent illegal trade in flora and fauna. So in the 2008 Farm Bill, the Lacey Act was amended to try and prevent trade in illegally logged lumber. That was the main focus of this. It was essentially an initiative started by some environmental NGOs to try and cut down on illegal lumber trade. As a result, it was sort of missed by the trade community because no one really thinks to look in the Farm Bill for trade-related issues. But the provision, the amendments of the provision, essentially require importers to declare the type, the genus, species, the type of plant material, and the location from where it was obtained. The problem is the definition of plant material is so broad and so vague as to be almost anything. It's not just illegal lumber or wood. It could encompass almost any kind of plant material.
So this sounds like it has all the makings of a truly costly bureaucratic nightmare.
That's right. You would be required to submit a declaration, and as I noted a minute ago, it's almost impossible to get the scope down at this particular point. The wording of the bill is, or the law, it is law in fact now, is so broad as to say, well, wood, that's fine, we can understand that, but it could come to mean any kind of plant extract. And so by our estimation, it could encompass as much as perhaps 85% of all HS chapters in terms of imports.
Mm. So what is the awareness level of this bureaucracy, this bureaucratic nightmare? Are companies aware of it, or are they shipping and then they become aware of it? What's going on with it?
Well, the original reporting requirement, and this, it's important to note that this is essentially a reporting requirement, that it's not going to stop you from importing things. You'll just need to make sure that you declare the plant material by genus and species and location from where you sourced the plant material when you import in. So it's not going to stop any imports.
What happens if you don't do that?
Well, the law says if you do not declare this or if you don't declare it properly, then the Justice Department can engage in forfeiture and seizure. The Justice Department will enforce this, although the law will be administered by the Agriculture Department, the Justice Department does have final enforcement actions on this.
Wow, this is crazy sounding, Doug. Is there anything that can be done about this at this point? No, you say it is law at this point.
It is law. The December 15th, 2008 deadline has been pushed back to April 1st, 2009, and initially only HS chapters 6 and 44, which cover essentially forest products, wood and products thereof, will need to declare. However, on a rolling basis of every 3 to 6 months, it is proposed that products further down the line, that would be furniture or musical instruments or picture frames, that sort of thing, would then come into effect on September 1st, 2009, and so far down as it continues on. Now, there is a chance for this to be, of course, amended. The rule has not been finalized yet. The Federal Register notice has gone out, and companies can write comments and make their views known. It is hoped, and Agriculture and Customs have promised, and in fact, those in Congress who wrote the law have also agreed that they certainly did not mean for this to be as far-reaching as it is, but it is that far-reaching at this point, as far as we know. So there will be opportunities to try and correct this, either technically or in new legislation, to minimize the scope and actually make sure it does what it was proposed to do, which is to prevent illegal trade in lumber.
So what is it that NAM members can do to have the most impact?
NAM members can certainly need to contact their members of Congress and let them know that this could potentially impact their imports. They need to be aware of the scope of this, that they may have to report all plant material and any import they bring in. The NAM is leading a coalition of manufacturers on this issue. Myself or Catherine Robinson will jointly head this up. So certainly NAM member companies who are concerned, who have questions, need to contact myself or Catherine.
Doug Gowdy, Director of International Trade Policy at the National Association of Manufacturers. Doug, thanks for being with us this week. I would like to welcome now to this special edition of America's Business the Executive Vice President of the National Association of Manufacturers, Jay Timmons. Jay, you have been a regular on the program the last several weeks leading up to the election this week, giving us your view and the status of the races, both for the White House and the congressional races as well around the country, particularly in the Senate. And you were pretty much right on your predictions.
Well, you know, the one good thing about predictions is nobody really remembers what they are afterwards. So
that's true.
And I like to say that even a blind hog can find an acorn now and again. So I was perhaps more lucky than anything else.
Okay. Having said that, how do you see the National Association of Manufacturers moving forward with the manufacturing agenda, which I might say has not changed, dealing with the new political reality in Washington?
You know, I'm actually very encouraged with the speech that the president-elect made on the night of his outstanding victory. And I really think he is looking to shape his government in a way that has not been expected. I was particularly impressed with some of the remarks he made about working with non-traditional allies. He quoted Lincoln when he said Lincoln said that a nation far more divided than ours said, "We are not enemies but friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. To those Americans whose support I have yet to earn, I may not have won your vote, but I hear your voice. I need your help, and I will be your president too." And I truly believe it's our obligation. It's the obligation of the business community and frankly, every American to work as hard as we can to ensure that President Obama succeeds. That's good for this nation, and it's good for our future.
As we make this recording, the Senate races, all of the Senate races have not been decided. There's still some hanging in the balance. Let's go over, if you would, those that are still out there to be decided, and then let's look at how the others shaped up as well. What's yet to be decided?
As we are recording this program, there are 57 Democrats and 40 Republicans in the new Senate, and there are four races that are still in question, but are solidifying. Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley has been declared the winner, and actually Gordon Smith, the incumbent Republican, has conceded. So that's what gives the Democrats the 57. The other three that are yet to be called finally are Minnesota, where incumbent Senator Norm Coleman leads Al Franken. He's won that race by 450 votes, but because it's so close, there's an automatic recount that state election law mandates. In Alaska, incumbent Senator Ted Stevens, who was just found guilty of some felonious actions, is ahead, but they haven't called the race yet because there are still some outstanding absentee ballots. And then lastly, in Georgia, Senator Saxby Chambliss, the incumbent Republican, has won the race, but the Georgia law requires that any statewide race receive 50% or higher, and he has 49.9% of the vote.
My.
He needs, as the canvassing over the next day or so unfolds, he needs to find 5,000 extra votes to put him over the top. That's not inconceivable, but the Chambliss folks are preparing for a runoff.
And what? Oh, so it would be a runoff if that doesn't happen.
Yes, I'm sorry. It would be a runoff, and it would be on December the 2nd.
Well, regardless of how those actually do come out, and obviously if there is a supermajority reached, that changes the whole dynamic drastically. But regardless, there is a stronger Democratic presence in the Senate. And as a result of that, there are those out there who would try to define the relationship with the new Congress and the new president and the NAM's agenda as an adversarial relationship. Fair, unfair, accurate, inaccurate?
Fairly silly, actually. Incredibly inaccurate, I would also say. One of the reasons for that is anybody who put their name on the ballot, who dared to stand for election, believes in the strong America. They believe in creating jobs, improving the quality of life for all Americans, and making sure that America is strong internationally, and making sure that we have the ability to compete and succeed in the international marketplace. That's our agenda at the NAM. So we share the same goals. The question is going to be how we get there. And we have seen, I believe, in our new president, a willingness to sit down with perhaps non-traditional allies and truly many constituency groups to talk about how each of us would approach this problem. You also have in the Senate in particular some very business-minded new members. Take Mark Warner in Virginia, for example. He started a business from the ground up and became incredibly successful. He was a very strong governor in the state. He was very popular with the business community because he understood what it took to create and retain jobs in this country. And I think he and many others will be good allies for us.
What are the priorities? What are the issues the NAM would like to see the new Congress and administration deal with first?
Well, they're really the issues that all Americans care most about. First and foremost is domestic energy supply to reduce the cost of energy in this country and lower our reliance on foreign sources. Competitive tax policy that creates growth and jobs in this country. Trade policy that expands markets overseas so we can produce more goods here to export. So, those are probably the top three that we would expect Congress and the administration to address, and we're ready to get down and get to work on them.
Jay Timmons, Executive Vice President of the National Association of Manufacturers. Thank you, Jay, for being with us this week.
Thank you, Mike.
Last week, we had pollsters John McLaughlin of McLaughlin & Associates, a Republican pollster, and Alan Rivlin of Hart Research, a Democratic pollster, on the program, giving their predictions on how election night would shake out and which way the polls were leaning. Well, election night has come and gone, of course, and John and Alan are back with us this week to look at what happened and check their predictions. Gentlemen, welcome back to America's Business. Let me begin with you first, John, if I might. What, if anything, last night surprised you?
I don't think the turnout was as high as I thought it would be. I mean, I'm looking at with 95% in, you have 119 million. And 4 years ago, you had 125 million. The makeup of it was different. It was certainly more Democratic. It was certainly younger. Yeah, a couple points more African Americans. But there must be some people that voted for Bush 2 years ago, 4 years ago, that were left at home. So I think that as we go through it, there'll be surprises here and there. But certainly the Democrats have the wind at their back. They had the message, and they were successful.
Alan, same question to you. Any gee whiz moment for you?
Well, you know, I am really pleased that there weren't a whole lot of surprises. I think the entire polling profession's reputation was on the line, and I was concerned that if the critics of polling turned out to be right, and there was almost a conspiracy among McCain and Obama and the media to say don't believe the polling. Because McCain didn't want his supporters to get discouraged, Obama didn't want his supporters to get complacent, and the media wanted everybody to tune in to find out what the real results were. It turned out to be a very good night for polling. We were, as a profession, fairly accurate. With you give us 20,000-30,000 interviews a night with spread among all the different organizations, and we can get it about right. So there weren't a lot of surprises. The Democrats' dreams were not fulfilled, but I think we did what we needed to do.
So your predictions, both of you, were correct then?
By and large,
yeah.
Right, good. So with your reputations coming out of this evening, or last evening, intact, let me ask you this question. In your polling, were you able to determine if this election was a repudiation of governing from right of center? In other words, has America, as a result of this election, made a seismic shift, or did this election just turn on other issues and other issues only, and I'm thinking primarily of the economy?
Let me take that first. And
John,
if you look
at
the national exit polls, the ideology is virtually the same as it was 4 years ago. The difference is the president is a lot less favorable, and the economy matters a lot more. And I thought it was ironic that Barack Obama was stealing, in effect, the economic agenda of the Republicans, where he was saying, I'm going to cut taxes for 95% of Americans. I'm going to cut wasteful spending with a scalpel. So he wasn't running and saying, like Walter Mondale, I'm going to raise your taxes and I'm going to really increase the size of government. He was running with the message that would appeal or at least would negate what was a Republican advantage.
Alan?
Well, I'm really pretty much going to agree with that right down the line and say I don't think John McCain lost in the election. I think that George Bush lost. And what was rejected, I don't know if it's a far right program, but it's ideologically dogmatic and filled with confrontation, and we don't need your votes. We can pass it all on just our own votes. That's what America was rejecting. Mm-hmm. It was a style of leadership, and I don't think change means change from the right to the left. I think it means change from Bush to centrist pragmatism. And I think Obama is sort of ran largely as a centrist. I do think that he borrowed a lot of Republican ideas in order to say, don't paint me as a liberal. And the other side tried to paint him as a liberal, but I don't think it stuck. What stuck was John McCain couldn't shake George Bush. He couldn't present enough of a difference from his approach where McCain would be different from Bush, and America rejected Bush and McCain went down with it.
When we come back, we'll hear more from pollsters John McLaughlin and Alan Rivlin on what happened on election night. I'm Mike Hambrick, and you're listening to America's Business. Please stay with us.
America's Business is your business. Mike Hambrick will be right back.
Welcome back to America's Business. It's the nation's top radio program on manufacturing. I'm Mike Hambrick. More now with noted pollsters John McLaughlin and Alan Rivlin. One thing for sure, it seems to me, is that Obama, the campaign, used technology to communicate with the electorate in a two-way communication. They communicate to them and heard from them. And I would imagine he would continue to use that technology as president and as he governs. Or will he be more moved by far-left elements in Congress that might push him in another direction?
First of all, I don't think there are far-left elements in Congress trying to push Obama away from centrist pragmatism. I think that's exactly what Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are really all about, as much as they try to be painted as something different than that. And I think the three of them are singing from the same hymnal that we will not have the support of the American public if we try to move far to the left. We can retain the support of the American public if we go down the center. But I do think the first half of your question was right on target. This was an amazing use of Facebook and Twitter and 25 other different kinds of new technologies to build not everyone in the campaign. Those of us who are older just sort of saw it going on. But the young people had their laptops, they were plugged in at all times and communicating with each other at all times, and it was really just amazing to watch.
John, your response to that?
I think the 4 years ago, the Republicans were very good at micro-targeting, very good at getting to contact a lot of people and bring them out through all different methods, some of it via email and via the internet, some of it just old-fashioned knocking on doors and calling their friends and neighbors and family. And clearly the Democrats went to school on that. They lost 4 years ago. They learned from that. And this time I think they really outdid the Republicans in a lot of respects, particularly in the technology aspect, particularly with the younger voters, where Obama was able to win 2-1 was ironic because a lot of this technology is generational. 4 years ago, the only group that John Kerry won was the voter under 30. This time around, the only group that John McCain won was the voters over 65.
Pollsters Alan Rivlin, a Democratic pollster, and John McLaughlin, a Republican pollster. Guys, let me thank you for being on today and also in previous weeks taking the time to come on the program and give us your insight. I really appreciate it, and it was very interesting. It was a great input. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Keep up the good work.
You're very welcome.
John McLaughlin of McLaughlin & Associates and Alan Rivlin of Hart Research, thank you both for being with me this week on America's Business. This week's edition of America's Business is almost a wrap. But before we go, as we always do, we leave you with the last word from the president of the National Association of Manufacturers, Governor John Engler. Governor?
The National Association of Manufacturers wants to congratulate Senator Barack Obama of Illinois, the new president-elect for our nation. Senator Obama and Senator Biden ran a spectacular campaign. Campaign no doubt aided by the tough economic conditions that America faces today, but a campaign brilliantly designed to reach out far beyond the traditional basis of Democratic support in the states that in recent presidential elections had not been competitive. In so doing, one of the things that I think was accomplished is that Senator Obama was able to touch millions of people who hadn't heard directly from a presidential candidate, and particularly a Democratic presidential candidate in recent elections, and maybe has built a broader mandate for action in Washington, action that we believe as manufacturers will be urgently needed. Today, the economy in America is weakening. We're in a recession. The global economy is weaker. So we say to Senator Obama, our new president-elect, that we stand ready to work with you. We congratulate you on your skill at running a winning campaign, and we wish you equal skill in putting together an administration to work with all of America to get to the point, as you've described, where we need to be, not a red America or a blue America, but a red, white, and blue America, a United States of America that can be prosperous in the 21st century, that can continue to have a manufacturing economy that leads the world. The manufacturers share that goal and will support you as we work together. Congratulations and good luck. I'm John Engler, and that's the last word.
Thank you very much, Governor. From Washington, D.C., I'm Mike Hambrick, reminding you to join me next week as we discuss issues, policies, and legislation that are important to America's business. As we close, I would like to thank my producers, Jonathan Lynn Hsu, Carter Wood, Keith Smith, Jeff Noah, Hank Cox, Matt Price, Angeline Shapiro, and James Scully, and, of course, my producer,
Alan Peterson. I'll see you next week, folks. And remember, if it's business, it's America's business. So long, everybody.
From Washington, D.C., this has been America's Business with Mike Hambrick.
Brought to you in part by Toyota. Toyota, moving forward. And by Microsoft Office Visio 2007. Visualize, explore, and communicate. And by the National Association of Manufacturers. We're the millions of people who make things.